It is my great privilege and honor to introduce to you our keynote speaker for this lunch event. Let me just say that in your information packages, there are detailed bios on all the main participants, and that includes, of course, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. So I'm not going to read a bio to you. I'm going to have more fun than that. It has been said that playing second fiddle is the hardest instrument in the orchestra. But as the number two in the Department of State, Rich Armitage plays that instrument extraordinarily well. He and the secretary function as a team, with Rich Armitage as his right arm and his left arm. Rich Armitage has legendary backstopping capabilities. Let me just say, as one who has occasionally been on an overseas mission myself, when you're out of town, it's nice to have air cover back home. You need the 24/7, 365 sort of person with passion and intensity to take on that job. And that sums up Rich Armitage. I don't know if there's anyone around Washington today who's managed to kill more bad ideas in a short span of time than our Deputy Secretary. But this only covers his capabilities on defense. He's a consummate offensive player as well, demonstrating that the administration and the team can indeed walk and chew gum. Exhibit A, of course, is the Secretary's exercise in personal diplomacy early in June and again a few weeks ago, instrumental in heading off what could have been a catastrophe in South Asia. He's also widely recognized for his many efforts in formulating sensible policies in East Asia, including keeping the Korean Peninsula on a political track. And I could go on and on, but I don't really want to do that because you came to hear him and not me. Rich is known for many things. He's known for his prowess as a weightlifter, but his basketball skills are less well known. He plays that with intensity that's passionate as well, I'm told. He is recognized in the foreign affairs and national security field. Less well known are his extraordinary skills as a human being, building teams, building a family, and creating an esprit among all those around him. Rich, we're glad to have you here with us.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I just said to Chet privately what I'll say to you publicly. I don't think I've ever had such a kind, gracious introduction, and I'm yet again in your debt. I'm in your debt again, Chet, because I look around at just the tables nearest to me, and I see some of the giants of the Foreign Service who've gone before us, you yourself, Walt, Dick Solomon. It's just unbelievable to look around this room, so thanks a million for inviting me. Now, you mentioned basketball. I'm up here right now wearing my latest trophy, a finger the size of Rhode Island. And that's from last night's game. I could barely limp up the stairs, but you might wonder what I'm doing playing basketball. Figure for a guy who's carrying the weight for a fellow 6'8", my growth spurt has got to kick in sometime, and I want to be ready for the big leagues when it does. I had a conversation this morning in the course of business with Senator Chuck Hagel, who's going to be one of your afternoon speakers, I believe, this afternoon, and he mentioned that I was going to precede him to the podium, and he felt quite sure that I set my usual low bar, which he would be easily able to leap over and sweep the table. So when you have Senator Hagel here this afternoon, please let him know that I let the secret out. Chet, again, thanks so much for the introduction. I believe you once wrote that the business of foreign affairs should be attempted only by the most talented, the most committed, and tenacious of people, who are prepared to act, quote, with relentless intensity. Well, I'm not sure how many of us in the administration would live up to that standard, Chet, but I think, as far as my experience is concerned, that you could well have been describing yourself. Now, this week marks an important annual ritual. As children all over the country return to school, some enthusiastically, or some like mine, less so. And in many ways, for most of us, the start of the school year is probably no different from any other, and that's a good thing. Last fall, President Bush urged Americans to return to our normal lives, to refuse to be terrorized. And by and large, we have lived up to his charge. So today, we've come back from the beach, and we've closed down the local pool. We bought new shoes for the kids. We've returned to the reassuringly familiar patterns of American life. But this year, we can't quite escape a sense of uneasiness and dissonance. Last year, when this young generation of school children, born into a mild season of peace and unprecedented prosperity, sat down to their desks, they had no way of knowing how deeply the world was about to change. They had no way of knowing that outside their classrooms, an insidious enemy was systematically invading our nation with a single-minded, ruthless intent. And they had no way of knowing that they'd started the year of war. And so we all learned a new lesson last September, and learned in a visceral way that a failed state in Central Asia, or for that matter, the curriculum in an obscure school in Pakistan, the political repression, grinding poverty half a world away, all can have a direct and devastating effect on the security of our nation. And so today, for the families of more than 3,000 who were killed in the attacks on September 11th, nothing feels the same. For the families of those who've been killed in action, of the 8,000 American men and women in uniform who continue to serve in Afghanistan, nothing feels the same. And for our family at the Department of State, we have lost far too many in this war. But for all Americans, even as we go about our lives, more or less as we did before, for all of us, nothing feels the same. And so today, we find ourselves and our nation in an era of difficult challenges and of profoundly deep changes. Now, I used to give a stock speech about the challenges the Department of State would face in the 21st century. And in many respects, I could give that same speech today. I could tell you about the need to shut down the spread of weapons of mass destruction and to calm down the violence in the Middle East and to cultivate China and Russia and India as partners rather than simply viewing them as competitors. We have to find a way to bring together the world to deal with the thorny transnational problems, from the brown cloud of haze over Asia to HIV/AIDS to trafficking in persons, and to make sure that all nations have the opportunity to know the benefits of a globalized economy. Well, these were the challenges the administration was prepared to face before we took office, and that we indeed continue to face on a daily basis now. But now there's a fundamental change in how we view these challenges. And I would describe this change as something of a conundrum. Today, America has unprecedented preeminence. We've got power, prestige, influence, and clout far beyond that known in the history of man. And this is true in all respects, economic, military, cultural, and political. In a way, you'd think that this should be all we need to address any challenge to our security, and yet we've never been more aware of our vulnerabilities. And who here among us has not felt this in a personal way? Who has not hesitated before opening an unexpected envelope from an unknown address? Who hasn't looked out the window or looked overhead to wonder if that plane didn't look a little too low, and wait to make sure that it turned away? So we have to ask ourselves this question. How do we harness our preeminence to meet the long-term challenges to peace, and yet at the same time deal with the immediate and overwhelming threat to our nation? Well, clearly there's not a simple answer, nor an easy one. But I believe that if we go about today's battles the right way, if we meet the immediate and the overwhelming threat of terrorism with the right blend of leadership, cooperation, and forethought, we will not only win the war against terrorism, we will be placing this nation in a far better posture to meet every other challenge to our security in the 21st century. And in that sense, we have in this post-September 11th world the opportunity to turn our vulnerability into strength. The past year has shown us what works, what it will take to triumph over terrorism to secure lasting peace and lasting prosperity. It will take strong and unapologetic American leadership. But it will also take the singular and concerted efforts of many nations. And it will take global remedies for the underlying pathologies, such as poverty, disease, and tyranny, that give rise to anger and to hopelessness and violence. These are the conditions that can deprive whole populations of their fundamental rights as human beings, and the conditions that all too often provide sustenance and shelter for terrorists. We know that winning this war against the global reach of terrorism will take that American leadership. It is fashionable today in some circles to deride the primacy of the United States. And there are times when we receive a certain amount of resentment from abroad. But when it actually matters, few would deny the importance of the U.S. role in nearly every issue of significance. Whether it is a territorial dispute involving Spain and Morocco over a tiny uninhabited island, or arriving at realistic measures for alleviating global poverty through sustainable development. As Secretary Powell says, we may not be the world's policemen, but the calls come to us when somebody dials 911. Indeed, no other nation in the world could have gone from no war plan on the shelf to such a full spectrum of operations in such a short space of weeks. We moved not just thousands of combat forces into the region and a vast array of equipment, everything from carrier battle groups to modern field hospitals, but we also mobilized the assets other than our military. We used our diplomatic muscle. We also worked with our allies to marshal a worldwide anti-terrorism coalition. We negotiated access and basing agreements and commitments to fight al-Qaeda from scores of nations. We used our financial clout. We worked with other nations to locate and freeze money trails for some 50 terrorist groups and organizations. We used our intelligence. We used our investigative powers. We uncovered and shut down scores of terrorist cells, including a number in other countries, where we joined together with counterparts to make arrests. And we used our economic might. We worked with partners in the public and the private sectors to provide thousands of emergency supplies and rations to people long starved by war and drought. And today, one result is that Afghanistan is not quite the same country it was a year ago. Not so long ago, al-Qaeda and the Taliban held terrible sway over the lives of 23 million people in that nation. Regardless of the recent spate of bombings, including the tragic events of today, that is simply no longer the case. And today's apparent failed assassination attempt will not stop President Hamid Karzai, the legitimate leader of Afghanistan, from continuing to bring his people together. President Bush reminded us at the outset that this would not be an easy victory, and we are in it for the long haul. But what we see in Afghanistan is that even with such a difficult situation, one with complicated root causes and solutions, confident, clear-eyed leadership from the United States is one prerequisite for progress. But in every instance I have cited, leadership was never synonymous with unilateralism. We act and will continue to act in our own interest whenever necessary, without asking for permission. But the fact is that we rarely act alone. So we also have to be confident and clear-eyed enough to know that there are limits to American preeminence. Multilateral cooperation has to be more than a tool of convenience to use when it suits us and only on our own terms. Otherwise, we will find over time that such instruments become blunt and broken at best, and that our preeminence will not serve us as well as we would hope. Today, we would not be winning the war against terrorism without effective multilateral cooperation. In fact, our national strategy had, from the outset, profound international implications. Consider that the al-Qaeda network had active cells hidden in the dark corners of some 60 countries, and that citizens of more than 90 nations perished on September 11th. It's fitting, then, that we swiftly saw an international agenda for countering terrorism. Days after the attacks, the UN Security Council adopted UNSC 1373, the most comprehensive anti-terrorism measure ever passed by the United Nations. And in the months since, regional organizations from the OAS to ASEAN have adopted similar conventions and similar measures. But nations have also put their military might and their money behind their rhetoric. Most nations in the world today are contributing something to this war consistent with their capabilities, and many are receiving some kind of assistance according to their needs. Over 180 nations are part of our coalition against terrorism. 122 offered the support of their military forces. 25 are now engaged in military operations, including Operation Enduring Freedom and the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. And at the same time, 132 nations have signed the International Convention to Suppress Terrorism Financing. 136 have contributed some other concrete assistance, running the gamut from humanitarian supplies to the use of airspace and landing rights. The relationships that we have built and the new momentum around counterterrorism have encouraged not just collaboration on this one issue, but patterns of cooperation that are helping us progress on other issues where we perhaps have less common ground, in places such as Central Asia, where today's cooperation does center around our counterterrorism efforts. But we are building a baseline that might lead to richer bilateral engagement on a cross-section of issues from economic development to human rights. I've just returned from a trip to Asia and South Asia where I saw the benefits of our partnership against terrorism. In India and Pakistan, and that was my second trip, as you mentioned, Chet, this summer, we not only discussed the direction for ongoing operations in Afghanistan and the overall direction for our promising but still emerging strategic and economic relationship, but we also continued to engage in diplomatic efforts, aided by the hard work of many other nations, particularly Great Britain, to dampen down the temperature and hopefully diffuse the tensions between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. In China, where I met with the foreign policy leadership, we prepared for the third summit with our two leaders, this one in Crawford in October. Our discussions included extraordinarily frank exchanges on topics that not always been easy to broach so directly. This included our approaches to regional issues from Central Asia to Russia to Taiwan. It included our views on human rights and religious freedoms and our views of the problems of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. I also had the opportunity to visit Sri Lanka, including the Jaffna Peninsula. And I can honestly say that I've not seen such a blasted, sad landscape in a long time, certainly since my service in Vietnam. And I spoke to Tamil and Sinhalese politicians and leaders and spoke about their weariness with the costs of war and how palpable was their desire for security. And indeed, Sri Lanka is now looking forward to the best chance in a generation to reach some kind of a peace settlement. We spoke of the possibilities for stepped-up relations with the United States. But I also saw a clear reminder of just how difficult a war against terrorism can be. For peace in Sri Lanka to stick, it will take political will and sustained effort to address the underlying resentments, inequities, and human rights abuses, which have long provided shelter and support for terrorists in that country. For Afghanistan, the conditions that have left a no less blighted land, 23 years of conflict, of repression, and privation, will be just as difficult to address and to redress. And while multilateral contributions will certainly be a key part of any military success, such cooperation is also essential to the longer-term effort to deal with the underlying conditions that drove that nation to such chaos. And indeed, if we look around the world, the evidence is clear. Poverty, illiteracy, disease, environmental degradation, hunger, repression, the lack of basic human rights, political participation, and economic opportunity. These are the conditions that give rise to desperation, to hopelessness, and ultimately to failed states. Too often this is where criminals and terrorists find their recruits and the refuge and safe haven where they can hide. So to secure the peace in Afghanistan and across the world in any lasting way, we must address these underlying conditions of conflict. And frankly, it's better and cheaper in terms of blood and money to resolve some of the problems that can feed and sustain terrorism than to have military operations against it. We do indeed have a moment of rare opportunity with the support of the American public and the urgency of this moment to mobilize domestic resources for aid and trade and investment on a scale not seen in half a century. Even so, of course, the United States cannot carry this burden alone, but our leadership can catalyze a broader international effort. In the reconstruction of Afghanistan, we can see how this has to be done. We cannot even begin to fix the almost chronic shortages of food and shelter without basic infrastructure, everything from sanitation to schools. And while the needs are truly overwhelming in the past year alone, there has been a lot of progress, I'm sure, as Zal Ghalizad probably pointed out to you this morning. We've helped clear over 1 million landmines and pieces of unexploded ordnance, which in turn has helped spur an 82% increase in crop production. We've seen the launch of more than 100 new public works projects. The United States has already committed funds to all of this, but the fact is, the only hope of meeting these needs on a scale required is the collective will of the international community. This international community, which committed $4.5 billion to reconstruction last January in Tokyo. So there's nothing inevitable about the return to peace and prosperity in Afghanistan, or for that matter, anywhere else. It will take sustained attention and sufficient resources. On the global level, this administration has committed both our attention and our resources. We are increasing funding for fighting crippling diseases such as HIV/AIDS. At the World Summit on Sustainable Development, we worked in cooperation with other nations to set realistic and reachable commitments. which will allow us to address in real time environmental degradation and sustainable development. President Bush is proposing the Millennium Challenge Account, which commits an historic increase of 50% in America's core development assistance, which over the course of 3 years will reach $5 billion a year over the current funding levels. These new resources will help nations who need it, nations which show a strong commitment to good governance, a strong investment in the health and education of their people, and an engagement with the economic policies that stimulate enterprise and entrepreneurship. And just as the administration has adopted policies better suited to a changing world, we've also changed ourselves and our way of doing business from the days these giants were roaming the halls of the State Department. We've reorganized and reformed our management structure to reflect the new priorities. We've put more funding into supporting our personnel overseas and at home, giving them the tools and skills for today's needs. They're concentrating on increasing and improving our public diplomacy to communicate the many good and generous policies of successive governments, and more importantly, the great story we have to tell about the enduring values and ideals of our people. Now, at the beginning of this long and rather hot summer, I had a chance to give commencement address to high schools. I said to those seniors that they started out the school year with hope and exuberance and enthusiasm, and they ended the school year in a nation at war. And it's true. These young people have been forever changed by what happened on September 11th. But in a strange way, maybe they've also gained something from the tragedy. Last fall, our president said, "In our grief and in our sadness, I see an opportunity to make the world a better place for generations to come." And perhaps this young generation of school children has an opportunity to regain the sense of purpose and vision, of affection for the things that really matter to us all, our families, our values, our faith in our democratic system, and the rule of law, in the dignity of human life and the sanctity of the basic right to freedom. Today in this war, we have an opportunity to secure a sense of national purpose, to join together American preeminence with a coalition of like-minded nations in a common fight, not just against a clear foe, but against the underlying conditions that allow such terrible tragedies to play out far too many places in this world. In winning this war, we have the opportunity to create not just a more secure nation for these children, but for all the children of this 21st century. Chet, thank you very much, and thank you all very much.
I'll let you recognize him.